This is the Beltline to Broadway podcast. I'm Lauren Van Hamert, your host, and on this episode, I'm chatting with Ashley Latimer. Ashley Latimer is a Tony Award-winning producer and writer who has worked on such shows as The Inheritance, Once on This Island, and Be More Chill. But perhaps she is best known to the Twitterverse as Mix Thief, the brand strategist behind The Lightning Thief, the Percy Jackson musical. Latimer nurtured the Lightning Thief's fan base on social media for almost 3 years, right up until the show closed on Broadway just over a year ago. That's about the time she revealed her true identity to her young fans and came out from behind her Mix Thief alias. But as she shared with me during the Southeastern Theater Conference in Louisville in February 2020, she learned as much from Camp Half-Blood as they did from her. Here is our conversation.
So I was super active on the now defunct Hapana boards, and I took a very academic approach to fandom. I mostly wrote essays quote-unquote think pieces on different theories, and it was a really, I think that was one of the first times that we had like a mainstream series coming out in real time as the fandom was building, where you got to, of course there have been other series, but where this was like in the people, anybody knows about Harry Potter, not just fans, and so much of the fan space was adapting all of this new technology at the same time. And I think that now fandom has really grown a lot, and technology has made it more accessible for people to be involved in a myriad of ways. If you were a cosplayer back in the 90s, you couldn't necessarily access or build a huge online platform for people to see your cosplay, and you had to go to the conventions and to the meetups and to the role-playing events. And now people can show off their cosplaying skills on Instagram. Or if you were in a tiny town where nobody you knew was into the same thing that you were, you often ended up feeling super isolated as opposed to feeling like there was this whole community. And now, I mean, we saw this with the Lightning Thief fans, this is truly a global fandom. There are kids and young adults and parents all over the world who are engaged in these characters and this story, and they're able to connect with each other seamlessly on social media. And I think that, I know that when I was in high school, I definitely had a few online friends who I'm still Facebook friends with. One of them, I was one of her betas, which those are the people who, if you're writing fan fiction, your betas read your chapters before they go up. And she and I have never met in real life still, even though she lives relatively close in North Carolina. But I didn't have a whole friend group the way that so many of these fans do now. I like watch, and it's really cool to see all of these friendships form in the mentions of these accounts for musicals or for movies. And I think that fans have also taken a lot of ownership, especially as being a fan has become a more mainstream affair, and it's no longer like you're automatically a social pariah just because you're a part of a fandom. So that's been cool to watch as well.
Was there anything about the Lightning Thief community that surprised you?
Just how they would say wholesome the community is. So often you see in fandoms, particularly the larger fandoms, that a lot of toxicity can form. And it's not to say that this fandom never has trouble, no one ever gets in fights. But I think that the source material is so inclusive and so much about a positive community, that that translates to how the fans interact with one another. And we really made that clear in our moderation from the get-go of, you know, it's okay for us to disagree on things, but we're not, even in a joking way, we're not going to veer into attacking one another. And watching how setting that standard, even when there would be little tiffs that would break out, they would then self-moderate and say, like, we know Mixed Thief is not going to tolerate us talking to each other like this. Let's not. They even now will sometimes joke. Sometimes they'll say something sassy to me, and then they'll be like, oh, wait, I need to be nicer. So I'm sorry, Mixed Thief. And they'll correct themselves. So, yeah, that was really pleasantly surprising, because going into it, I had seen other fan spaces where it could be toxic, and I was like, okay, this is going to be, you know, this could get scary, but they were so lovely. And in that fandom, the biggest arguments are things like how to pronounce the Percy and Annabeth ship name, whether you say Perkabeth or Persabeth. So it's easy to keep things clean in those discussions.
You also said they empowered you a lot because you came out right around that time. Can you speak to that a little bit?
Yeah, so I came out a few months before I started working on the show. So I came out about 4 days after the 2016 election, and not to get too political, but there were nine reported suicides of trans kids in the days right after that election. And I had been really nervous about coming out because I worked at a children's theater, and that was my main community in my hometown. And I'd worked there for 8 years before I moved to the city. That's really where I grew up and became a young adult and then an adultier adult. And, you know, there are lots of stereotypes in media about how teachers in particular are viewed once they come out as part of the LGBT community. So I was nervous that kind of backlash may exist. And I was really lucky that, and I was honest about that, that was one of the reasons that I hadn't come out. And I was really lucky that moms and other parents and grandparents like swooped into my comments, and they were like, we love you and support you no matter what. But I still felt nervous about owning my identity and also coming out as bi, and that for some reason felt a little bit trickier. And watching, like, knowing that the reason I came out when I did was I was like, I knew I had trans students at the theater, and they, I was like, oh my gosh, like these kids are like 7 and 8 years old. If they can own their truth, then I can, and I want them to know that they have a safe adult in this community no matter what. And so then in turn, watching how vibrant and proud all of the LGBT kids in the Half-Blood fandom and Demigod fandom are, and also how supportive the kids who are cisgender and heterosexual are to their queer friends in the fandom, made me want to stand in that vibrancy as well. And it also called me back to, like, the reason I came out in the first place is to be in service of the young people in my network. And I want to be in service to these kids as well.
I love that. You are also a Tony Award-winning producer.
Yes.
And one of the producers on The Inheritance. What is the state of LGBTQ theater right now? And, two-part question, why is LGBTQ representation on stage so important?
So I think that we've definitely seen a lot of growth in the past decade in having mainstream LGBTQ representation on some of the biggest stages in the world. But we can't, like, rest on the laurels of that. And I think that it's important with every production. Something that feels so difficult is that there's been such a historical lack of that representation that so often, and you see this with lots of different representation for different minority groups, where there's a pressure for each show or each book or each movie to represent everyone in the community because that community is so hungry for that representation. And so I think that any show that gets created that represents the LGBT community has a responsibility to move things forward, and then for everybody to learn from that experience and see how we can keep going. You know, it's not enough to just have had Fun Home and be like, all right, we've got a lesbian show and now it's in the canon. And, you know, or to one of my favorite shows in the past few years was Head Over Heels, which I wrote about after seeing that the first time. Like, that was the first time that I got to see a princess character who I was like, I could borrow that dress. And I remember seeing The Color Purple, which is about Black women, but I felt so represented by the character of Sophia and how she was this character who was like still worthy of like being loved, and that was never questioned by her size. And so I think that, you know, we're seeing more and more pieces, but that doesn't mean that it's just time to be like, oh, well, we've done it. We've done as much as we can. So I think it's really important to keep going. And I think the reason it's so important is because this seeing yourself saves lives. Not only because, and I think too, that's why it's so important for us to continue moving past the coming out narrative for LGBT characters, or the feeling good about myself, developing good self-esteem narrative for fat characters. Because now we need to see ourselves as something beyond that story as well. What happens next? What happens after you've come out? What happens after you feel good about yourself and now you're ready to date from a place of feeling empowered? And that tells young people and older people who didn't get that content when they were younger, who are still struggling, that it's okay. And that you can be the main character and you can have a vibrant, exciting, full life, and that there isn't just one path, because not all fat people are funny and not all you know, LGBT characters are sassy
or sidekicks or
right, yeah. You know, and so I don't consider myself like a particularly like comedic oriented performer. And when I was growing up, all of the roles for the most part that I saw for characters of size were like the funny sidekick or the comedic relief in some way or another.
The best friend.
Right, right. You know, and not all LGBT people work in entertainment or media. Like, some are doctors or secretaries or just parents. And so I think that the more we see that media, the more it tells us there's more than one story.
Not every community is as lovely and engaging and warm as the Lightning Thief community. So if you had to write a rule book for theater fandom online and even off, what might that rule book say?
I mean, I think that there is a huge opportunity to take up the mantle of responsibility for social media managers and community managers. I think so often there's a hesitancy to engage with the deep questions of the community that turns into, you know, people having those toxic fights or feeling ignored. One of the most pivotal days that I had as while I was working on The Lightning Thief was the day that we put out our Pride flag logo for 2019. And I had decided, I was like, I want the design to include every flag that is family appropriate. So like one of my colleagues was like, are you gonna put the Bears flag on there? And I was like, okay, maybe not that, but I wanted it to be as inclusive as possible. And I used a lesbian flag that for people my age, it has a black triangle on it, and which is also the same way that LGBT people were labeled as queer in the during the Holocaust. And for people my age, and a lot of the like lesbian friends or artists that I talked to about it or did reading on, like, that's a symbol of reclamation for them. But for our mostly Gen Z fandom, that is still considered a representation of oppression. And so when I posted the flag, or the logo that had that flag included, they immediately were like, why are you doing this? This is so wrong. And I have seen, you know, these things happen with other accounts, and it's immediately like, oh God, we're just gonna delete it and ignore it. And the reason so often that, especially with young people, that they are shouting, whether it just feels like they're shouting because they're such a high volume or they're literally all caps shouting at you, it's because they're used to not being listened to or even noticed if they don't shout. And so often it's just noticed, but then there's no engagement. There's no asking for feedback of why does this feel wrong. And so I was like, no, we're going to rumble on this. We're going to figure out what we did wrong here. And so I reached out to one of the first people who had responded and said, why are you using this flag? And I said, you know, we want to make this right. You have no obligation to engage with this. I understand that it was harmful, and you don't owe us your emotional labor, but we would love for you to be a part of this discussion as I fix this flag. So several of them had already posted, like, this is the flag you should be using. So I went back, changed the design, fixed it, showed it to the person that I had reached out to, and they immediately went from being like, this is the worst thing you've ever done on this account, to, oh my God, like, no one ever listens to us. The fact that you even reached out is such a big deal. And then I posted a thread and acknowledged what we had done wrong and where we messed up, and said, this is why we made this decision, but this is why we understand that it was not as supportive as it could have been and as inclusive as it could have been, and thanked them for calling us in on that. And then we posted the new flag, and they were so appreciative. And so if I could put like one rule in, it would be engage with a Herculean amount of humility, and don't be afraid to, you know, get into the weeds with the community that you're supposed to be supporting and representing. I think especially as shows start to have content that feels more, that it, like in the show, it's more inclusive, it's more representative, what that requires is that the people who are doing social media for those shows, it's a tough job. We're like on the front lines, so to speak. No, whether it is a ticketing issue or someone has said something that someone feels is offensive, or someone can't find the stage door, like the social media manager is the first person to hear about that. even things that we have zero control over. And I think that being willing to engage, being willing to mess up and act like there is a real person behind there, so that they know that, so that it's not just some like faceless corporate entity trying to get points for like quote unquote knowing the memes or knowing the lingo and having like this like surface level representation, but actually engaging is important.
Latimer is working on several book projects. Her first picture book, Francis Discovers Possible, is set to come out in the spring of 2022. You can learn more about her upcoming projects and what she's been up to on her Patreon page. I'll put a link in the episode notes. If you like what you've heard today, please consider subscribing to this podcast, leaving us a review, following us on social media at Beltline to Broadway, or visiting us online at beltlinetobroadway.org. Until next time, I'll see you at the theater.